were asked, and so I want to start with those. It'll take up a little bit of our time. The first one, if I can bring it up here. Forgot to do one thing. Okay. The first question is this. So the angels sang when the earth was recreated after the flood because the fallen angels who had tried to blend themselves with man to obliterate the human line, right? Okay, well, let me straighten out a couple of things about Job 38. So go ahead and turn there. Job 38, verses 4 through 11. Job is just before the book of Psalms, although chronologically, where would Job fit? He is the first book written, we think. Well, that depends, though, on some other issues, which we won't go into. But time-wise, chronologically, where does he fit in Genesis? Yeah, just before Abraham. He probably crossed, you know, over lifespan with Abraham. Job 38, 4 through 11. I tried to work all this out before last Wednesday, but I was unable to do so, and I wanted to contact some people that are very good in this area. Since then, I've been able to finish my research and come to some conclusions that are more certain. Job 38, 4. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? This is God to Job. Now, if you have a study Bible or you have cross-references in the margin, you'll see there's a cross-reference to Job 38, 4 of Psalm 104, verse 5. Does anybody see that? Does anybody have that? Okay, wonderful. So hold your place here and turn to Psalm 104, verse 5. Psalms, the book of Psalms is the next book. And you'll notice the similarity if you look at Job 38:4 and Psalm 104:5, you'll see. Here's Psalm 104, verse 5. He established the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. Now the Psalm, if you keep reading, you'll see is describing the earth being reestablished after the flood. And it sounds similar to Job 38:4. Talking about the foundation of the earth and so forth, but similarity doesn't always mean identity. Two passages can sound very similar, use the same terms and so forth, but that doesn't mean identity. People in the rapture discussion always get confused over passages that are similar but not identical. Okay, for example, second coming passages after the tribulation have similar terminology to passages that involve the rapture. That doesn't mean they're identical events necessarily. What you're interested in, of course, is the differences. Every war has similarities. You know, people die. Some form of weaponry is used. There's bloodshed. Does that mean that every war is the same war? So people know this intuitively, but you have to make sure you see there are differences. I don't want this to die. Anyway... So Job 38:4 and Psalm 104:5 are similar, but I don't think they're identical because Job goes on in verses 5, 6, and 7 to describe things that do not have a parallel in Psalm 104:5 through 9. They just don't have a parallel. So I've concluded that Job 38:4 through 7 refers to the creation week. And then in Job 38:8, look at the verbiage again here, beginning in Job 38:8. Or who enclosed the sea with doors, when bursting forth it went forth, or went out from the womb? Now when do you read about waters erupting out of the earth in creation week? I never read that, because that's not creation language. Verse 9, when I made a cloud its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band. Again, That's a post-flood description of the aftermath that set up the conditions for what we'll show later, an ice age. In verse 10, and I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors, and I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther, and here shall your proud waves stop. Now that's all flood terminology after the global flood of Noah. That's the promise of no more global flood. The waters only go so far. God set boundaries after the flood. They can't go any further since that day. And if you just read those verses with me and you look in the margin at your cross-references, through Job 38, 8, 9, 10, and 11, you will see parallels to Psalm 104, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Okay? So this is a reference to the flood in Job 38, 8 through 11. But Job 38, 4 through 7, where the angels are mentioned there at the end, that is a reference to creation. Okay? So that would contradict the possibility that I laid forth last week that the angels were singing for joy at the flood. I mean, they may have been singing then, I don't know, but Job 38, 7 doesn't support that they were. And finally, I got a hold of one of my mentors who did all his research on the creation and flood texts when he was at Dallas Theological Seminary in the 60s, right in the wake of Henry Morris and John Wickham's earth-shattering book, The Genesis Flood, which was written in 1961. And his conclusions were the same. Job 38, 4 through 7 are the creation, and Job 38, 8 through 11 are the flood. But, yes, to answer a second portion of your question here, this blending of the angelic realm with the human realm, yes, they were trying to corrupt the human gene pool. And why would they do that? Anybody have any idea?
Contaminate the seed.
Contaminate the seed. The seed promise of Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, that the seed of the woman would come forth and he would crush the seed of the serpent, or Satan. Okay? So notice it says, you know, in Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman. It doesn't say the seed of the man. It says literally the sperm of the woman. And so that's why Genesis 6, which gives you a hint for the virgin birth, but in any case, that's why Genesis 6, as we turn there now, and to consider the question of the Nephilim and these offspring, the strange offspring that came forth from this intermarriage, Genesis 6 is referring to one-way marriages. Did you ever notice that? It's always the sons of God taking to themselves the daughters of men. It's never the daughters of God taking from the sons of men. It's always one way. And that's why there's an attack here on the female side of the race. It goes back to Genesis 3:15, that the seed of the woman would be the source of redemption. And so there's a corruption to her seed that is being attempted here. And there's a lot involved in that attack and a lot of discussion revolving around this question in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. One side is arguing that the intermarriages here are between the godly line of Seth and the ungodly line of Cain. So they would say it's just human intermarriages between believers and unbelievers. That leaves a lot of questions unanswered. For one, it's always a one-way marriage. It's always the sons of God intermarrying the daughters of men. Never daughters of God intermarrying sons of men. For another, sons of God always, without any single exception in the entire Old Testament, refers to angels. The Beniha Elohim. Third, it doesn't explain the offspring in verse 4. Normally said to be the Nephilim, but later called the mighty men of the Gibborim, at the end of the verse, the mighty men, that are the products of this intermarriage. So I think I've taken a position for a number of years after studying this. It's clearly angels intermarrying with daughters of men to corrupt the pure human genetic line so that the Messiah would not be a true human. Now, if you remember, in the pre-flood world, there was not a human government. Okay, the sword was not in the hands of man. The sword was in the hands of the angelic realm, as we see from Genesis 3. They exercise authority on the earth. They have the sword, and the sword in the scriptures is always a symbol for the civil government. And so during this time, this era between the fall and the flood, angels lived alongside men, okay? Immortals lived alongside mortals in the same world. Okay, that's not a problem. In fact, we'll have mortals and immortals living together again in the millennial kingdom. But that's not a problem, because if you accept any of the other places in Scripture where angels contemporarily manifest themselves in a physical form, in a material way, then you shouldn't have a problem with it before the flood. And every reference we have to angels appearing, they appear as men. And all through Scripture, angels appear as men. But it's more than appearance, see? They're real physical entities when they do this. This bothers people, but it's very true, because one knocks Peter over, about knocks him right out of prison, in the book of Acts. We have angels throughout the Old Testament who are destroy men, kill men in battle, all through the Old Testament. How do they interact with the physical realm? So they can temporarily manifest themselves physically and interact with the physical, material universe. So with respect to the intermarriages, because here we have a serious interaction between the angelic realm and the human, I'd say that when they manifest themselves this way, before the flood, they had some kind of a genetic information. Either DNA or some similar encoded information that can successfully recombine with the female ovum and create an offspring. Now that should not be a problem for you at all if you believe that angels, other places in Scripture, have interacted with the physical material world. Shouldn't be a problem at all. DNA is just physical. It's chemicals. That's all it is. So I don't know that if the offspring of an angel that resulted in Nephilim, I don't know if it would be viable or not. That question I can't answer. I tend to think that they could. But I do know that an angel and a female can produce a living offspring that is what we might call a freak of nature. It's called a Nephilim here in Genesis 6:4. Now, these offspring that came forth have certain characteristics. For one, Genesis 6:4, they're always, always male. Always. So that shows you they have at least something that is analogous to what we know as the Y chromosome, because the testes determining gene is on the Y chromosome. And expression of that gene is what causes the distinctives of female anatomy to stop developing. See, everybody starts off, and I know this will be an embarrassment to the men, but everybody starts off to forming a female anatomy. And you can tell every time a man is walking around with his shirt off that this is so. But the development stops or halts because the expression of this testis-determining gene, which produces testosterone, of course, it will arrest that development process. And if later in life, if a man, if that gene is destroyed or expression of it is somehow inhibited, then men can begin to form female characteristics to various degrees. And we all know this. But whatever these angels contributed genetically, it caused 100% of the offspring to be male, no females. So for what it's worth, strange things occurred at that time on earth. Notice I said this happened on earth, okay? Angels in heaven are not given in marriage, but this occurred on earth. Okay, apparently God permitted this in the world before the flood. And that brings us to this person's second question. But Genesis 6:4, and they're quoting, "The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward." So weren't they still around post-flood? When question is afterward. Answer, this involves us more in the issue of the Nephilim, the offspring of this angel-female union. Did this freak offspring occur before and after the flood, or only before? When is the afterward? Okay, good question. As for the Nephilim, you'll notice the translators didn't want to deal with this word too much. They just transliterated. I think in some translation they actually translate it. But some don't really know what to do with this word. The word means fallen ones. Okay, fallen ones. The idea that they were giants comes from the Jewish translation in the Greek around 200 years before Christ. They translated this word gigantes, G-I-G-E-N-T-E-S, which means titans or giants. We don't know for sure if they were giants, but they were gigantes, as the Hebrews translated to Greek. They were superhuman in many ways, perhaps in size, but we don't know for sure in size. They may have been bigger, they may not have been. They probably were. I tend to think that they were, because the end of verse 4 describes them as, quote, "the mighty men who were of old, men of renown." But that's still, they could have just been superhuman in other ways. So the Gibberim, the mighty men, that signifies they were definitely very strong. Great strength. More so than your average man. So I don't know for sure. But these were the freak offspring that lived on the earth. It says in verse 4, in those days, okay, that's Noah's day there, whenever this was spoken, and also afterward. So what does the afterward refer to? Well, if you look at verse 3, what did God say? He said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. Now, if you take that as a timetable from when this was written, down to the time of the flood, then the expression means that these offspring were on the earth for the 120 years before the flood. And then they were destroyed, and that's all. Okay, so the purpose of the flood was to destroy this genetic offspring, the Nephilim, that resulted from this strange intermarriage. Now, who were the angels who did this? Okay, well, there were some of the angels that fell when Satan fell between Genesis 2 and 3. So this is not the fall of Satan when one-third of the angelic realm fell. This is a later incident involving some of those fallen angels. Peter tells us, and if you want to turn to Peter, 2 Peter, chapter 2. In fact, no, let's turn to Jude first. Jude comes just before Revelation. Let's look at Jude 6 and 7. Now, our argument has been that strange flesh intermingled with strange flesh, angelic flesh with human flesh. And I use flesh with in association with angels because it was a strange event that happened in there when they materialized. Verse 6 of Jude, "And angels who did not keep their own domain but abandoned their proper obeyed, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire." So look, there's a similarity between the events that happened in Genesis 6 with these angels who did not keep their own domain and the events that occurred in Sodom and Gomorrah over in Genesis 18. Strange flesh went after strange flesh. Now, it wouldn't be strange flesh for an unbeliever to marry a believer. That happens all the time. But something's not right with what's going on in Genesis 6. And notice the conclusion of verse 6 here. He has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Now if you turn to 2 Peter chapter 2, so you'll turn back to the left, but staying after Hebrews. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Or let's start verse 4. "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell," that is Tartarus. That is the Greek word Tartarus. It's not just the regular word for hell. Okay, in other words, this is a distinct compartment or location. Okay, Tartarus, "and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly." And notice, that's all associated, this angels that he did not spare in verse 4, is associated there with the times of Noah, contextually. And so we think this happened before the flood. So, it happened in the times when Genesis 6 was written, and for the 120 years that remained until the time of the flood, and then they were destroyed. So that now we had, coming out of the ark on the other side of the flood, a pure line of human genetics through Noah and his family. So the seed promise could be fulfilled in the Messiah. Now someone will say, well, the Nephilim are mentioned again after the flood in the book of Numbers, Numbers 13:33. True they are, but who are they said to be their descendants of? Anak. And who's Anak a descendant of? Canaan. And who's Canaan a descendant of? Ham. Okay, and so this is a pure human line. It's just there is some differences in the Anakim and the Rephraim in the Old Testament genetically. These people sort of manifest some strange characteristics. So Nephilim just means fallen ones. It's my understanding that these fallen ones, some in the line of Anakim and Rephraim, had some genetic distortions, some strange characteristics. Of course, they didn't know about genetics, okay, but they would see manifest in their external characteristics some abnormal things. And this has been seen in the human gene pool after the flood. Okay, the cause of these distortions, and I introduce a new term to you here, but the cause of these distortions in the post-flood world is what we call genetic load. You'll hear me use that a number of times later in the class. Genetic load means there is a loss of alleles due to selection. Okay, that doesn't mean a lot, so let's explain. Now, we don't have a problem with selection, by the way. Okay, natural selection, when it's understood properly. Okay, because it just natural selection just means a narrowing or loss of information as organisms interbreed. Okay, a loss or narrowing of genetic capability as organisms interbreed. There are limitations, we would say, in the structures that can be produced when two animals interbreed or two people. or two birds or two fish. Okay, there are barriers into how many different things they can manifest themselves as. Now, there are three kinds of selection. Natural selection, that's where organisms in nature breed together by choosing one another from some set of selective criteria. Secondly, there's artificial selection, and that's where human beings choose the two organisms that they want to breed together to manifest a certain trait. This is what got Darwin all excited. He said, look, if we can take pigeons, and we can take this pigeon and that pigeon, and we can put these pigeons together, we can make a pigeon that does this or does that and has all these strange characteristics, then maybe nature can do that, or maybe that happens in nature. Of course, not a problem. Okay? And then there's, of course, God's selection. That's when God narrows the gene pool down to selectively choose which organisms are left on the earth for interbreeding. When did God narrow both the animal gene pool and bird gene pool and human gene pool down? At the flood. Okay. So he chose which animals and which men, okay, and so forth, would be alive on the earth for interbreeding. So after the human beings got off the ark, there was only eight of them. I mean, this is all the genetics that are in the world for human beings coming off that ark. And so that means that all the genetics of the human race that exist today, all the possible characteristics, are exclusively held in those eight people. And what this did was increase what is called genetic load. What it means is that certain alleles, coded portions on a particular locus on the chromosome, are those the only things that can give rise to whatever traits are held there. So whatever genetic capabilities were there before the flood that did not come across in one of those eight individuals are totally lost forever. Okay, in other words, what I'm saying is that diversity was lost, okay, at the flood. There was more differences among human characteristics before the flood than there ever will be after the flood. Okay? So, greater diversity in the human genome before the flood than we have after the flood. Which was God's whole point, remember? Of the global flood of Noah, Genesis 6. What alleles did he want to get rid of? He wanted to get rid of the alleles of these freak offspring, the Nephilim, that had distorted the human genome. Okay? But the point we want to make about the post-flood Nephilim and other people into our own day is that now the gene pool has narrowed down and we have more and more mutation problems because of this issue called genetic load. Okay? That increases the possibility that mutant traits that are held on recessive genes or alleles are going to be expressed. That's why you don't want to get too closely married today. Now, that wasn't a problem before the flood at all. No, where did Cain get his sister? Or get his wife? Well, obviously he married his sister. I mean, this is silliness because we don't have the problems of genetic load before the flood. We have the problems of genetic load after the flood. And that's why Leviticus 19 comes in and God says, now, here are the marriages you should not be engaged in because God knows about genetic load. They didn't know about it. They didn't have Gregor Mendel. They hadn't read what he'd written. But God knew, and he said, this is not a good idea to marry too closely. And so he gives certain outlines of Leviticus 19. But we don't want to marry close today because of this problem in the post-flood world. But that is why you read about Nephilim, or so-called giants in the Old Testament. You read about people in Samuel who had, you know, six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot. People who were 9, 10, 11, 12 feet tall. Okay, this is not even unheard of today. There have been men in the last century who have been over 8.5 feet tall. So that capacity is embedded still today in our genetic code. There are people alive right now who have six digits on each hand and foot. Okay, and some have seven. And by the way, yes, there are bones in all of those fingers. All six of the toes have bones inside of them. It's not just skin deformation. And this is a condition doctors know as polydactyly. So this is simply due to genetic load. This is not due to the intermarrying of angels and some human being. Okay, those angels that did that before the flood were locked away according to 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. They were locked away according to Jude chapter 6, verse 7, never to do this again. They existed for 120 years and then they were wiped out. All right, is that somewhat clear? Other than the genetic load part. All right. Tonight we want to look briefly at an accommodation attempt called the framework hypothesis or literary framework. I mentioned this last week. It's gaining in popularity though. I want to make sure we're clear on it. This is gaining ground, especially in the conservative evangelical seminaries. That's why we're going to look at it. It was really popularized by Meredith Klein in 1958. A few men that came before him, I'm notified, but Klein became the influential one to carry this forward. Klein was a very influential theologian. I read quite a bit of his stuff on suzerainty vassal treaties and Deuteronomy and so forth. It's very important. He's got a lot of stuff that is sometimes good, but he's got some serious issues with young earthers. Here's what he says. I regard the widespread insistence on a young earth to be a deplorable disservice to the cause of biblical truth. Now, really what you're reading here is someone, unfortunately, who is embarrassed about what the Bible says. You'll find this a lot in academic circles because they want to maintain intellectual integrity among their peers. And it's not very popular to hold on to a literal Genesis. So they come up with these academic views that sound really credible. Here's the view. I have advocated an interpretation of biblical cosmogony. That word means origin of the universe. Okay. I've advocated an interpretation of biblical cosmogony according to which Scripture is open to the current scientific view of a very old universe and does not discountenance the theory of the evolutionary origin of man. So he's open to an old earth and also macroevolution. That is that all species originate from a single life form or a single cell, okay, including man in this case. Now, he held that as of 1996, at least. He's passed away since then, so I don't know if he holds to the evolutionary end of man, which would be that you just return to dust and that's it. But in any case, he held to the evolutionary origin of man. So to be consistent, you'd have to hold to both ends. Notice this is his interpretation in Genesis is, quote, open to the current scientific view. The way he interprets to make it open to current scientific view is to make Genesis 1 just a literary device. And what he's saying is that Genesis 1 is not recording any real events that ever took place. Okay, that's his position. Okay, it sounds real credible, like I said, but then when you cut through all this stuff, he's saying nothing happened. When God said, let there be light, that didn't really happen. Okay, that's just a literary device. Okay, it's just there to teach us something about God. So he reinterprets, right? But the brilliance of his thing is, and it is sort of brilliant, if I wanted to evade this, I would have loved to have been the one who thought up this view. But his reinterpretation doesn't mean that you have to reinterpret over and over and over. In other words, when science comes along and says, now we want to adjust and we want to say that the age of the earth is even more or less than it was before, he doesn't have to go back and change his interpretation. He says, well, it's just a literary device. It's not even an account of creation. Okay, that way I don't have to go back and reinterpret. Kind of brilliant. Now here's how he says it. As far as the time frame is concerned, with respect to both the duration and sequence of events, the scientist is left free of biblical constraints in hypothesizing about cosmic origins. Okay, so see, it's not Genesis 1 didn't have anything to do with that. Everything we said about, evening and morning, okay, everything we said about the numerical adjective preceding the word yom at the end of each day, all that, see, it's all just totally tossed here. He's done away with it. So the key to his view is that Genesis is not supposed to be taken literally. Now, how does he know that? What are his arguments? Well, first he says, you can tell from this literary framework or arrangement of Genesis 1. He says, you have 6 days. They really aren't days. Okay, they're not really days. They're just 6 frames. Think of each one of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, as just a frame, arranged into 2 panels. This would be panel 1, this would be panel 2. And he comes along and he says, now look, if we look at the language of the first frame in panel 1 and the first frame in panel 2, we notice a similarity. And then we see a similarity here too. And we see similarities here also. So we have similarities between frame 1 and 4, frame 2 and 5, frame 3 and frame 6. And he says, therefore, we cannot understand these as sequential. Okay? There's too many similarities to say they're identical. Okay? So this is how he says it. We'll just look at day 4 and day 1. He says, day 4 is the light bearers, right? Sun, moon, and stars. Day 1, God said, let there be light. But the scriptures don't say that was the sun, but here's what he says. Day 4 thus brings us back to where we were in day 1. and in fact takes us behind the effects described there to the astral apparatus that accounts for them. See, he doesn't say sun. See, this is academic. See, we call it the astral apparatus. The sun, okay? This is the literary sequence is then not the same as the temporal sequence of events. See? Now he concludes. Okay, so the same thing is done with the other similar frames. Okay, and it sounds so academic, but it's just baloney. Okay, he, like many people, cannot conceive of light independent from the sun. And so he has to have the sun to account for the light on day one. Well, that's on day four, so we just bring it back and stick it behind day one. So therefore, obviously, it's not sequential. Then he concludes a very involved section on upper registry time and lower registry time, which Moses, I'm sure, knew so much about when he wrote Exodus 20, to conclude this. The creation week is to be understood figuratively, not literally. The second reason, he says, and this is the last one, the days are not literal, is on the basis of Genesis 2:5. Genesis 2, verse 5. Which says, we've seen this attempt before. I wonder if anybody will figure out where we've heard this attempt before. It didn't exactly come from evangelical conservatives the last time I read this sort of an argument. Verse 5, now no shrub of the field was yet in the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprouted, for the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to cultivate the ground. He says that contradicts day 3 where it says plants were created with seed in them. See, he goes back to chapter 1. Verse 11, it says, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after the kind, with seed in them that is mature. See, and it was so. And he says, then Genesis 2 comes along and says, there was no plant of the field that had even yet sprouted. So that contradicts, because you've got mature plants on day 3. Genesis 2:5, you've got no plants. So see, contradiction. So therefore, this is not supposed to be sequential. This is just figurative. Now, we already studied why this is a failure a couple weeks ago when we studied the liberal interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2. The liberal always says, well, there's two accounts of Genesis. You've got Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and they're in contradiction. Now, Klein is saying basically the same thing, and he's supposedly an evangelical conservative. Now, does anybody remember the answer to this? What's the ancient literary form by which Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 were written? What's it called? Okay, it's called a doublet. Okay, a doublet. Okay, if you can't remember that, you need to write it in the text so you'll remember when somebody comes with these kinds of arguments. A doublet means you have two descriptions of the same event. The first description will be a chronological account. The second description will go back and will amplify specific themes from that chronology. But the second account is not trying to give a chronology. It's just like we said, journalistic writing. Have you ever seen that style done where an author, he says a few things to sort of summarize, and then he'll go back and he'll pick up a theme and he'll work with that for a while. He'll go back, he'll pick up another theme. Does it have to be chronological to do that? In fact, most of them are not chronological. They jump around in the story. Go back, talk about this basketball player, then, now we're going to go talk about him, but they'll talk about him in the fourth quarter, then him in the second quarter. And so it's not necessarily written that way. This is a journalistic style. And we know this. In fact, we know this because we see doublets in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. We see doublets in Joseph's life later in Genesis. So this is not uncommon in ancient Near Eastern literature. This is not uncommon in the book of Genesis itself. So there's no reason to say, well, Genesis 2:5 contradicts Genesis 1:11. Okay? Genesis 2:5 isn't even trying to be a chronological account. Alright, so by those two arguments, Klein says Genesis 1 should not be taken literally, it should just be interpreted figuratively and differently than later portions of Genesis, which he grants should be taken literally. Now, we'll combat some of this later, some of this playing around with the question of Genesis 1 and whether it's figurative or literal. Is it a different genre so that it merits different rules of interpreting? The long or the short of it is, as Stephen Boyd says, it is statistically indefensible to argue that this text, Genesis 1 and 2, is poetry. It's just not there. The verbs are not there for poetic sections. All right, let's turn to two other accommodation strategies. Now, by accommodation, let's get clear what we mean. We mean just trying to bring the Bible together with the framework of modern science. Okay, we're not against science. In fact, many of the scientific disciplines today do not have to have the evolutionary framework to work. Okay? Many people work in scientific fields that without reference to evolution. Okay? They could go about drilling for oil and being petroleum engineers without any reference to this framework. In other words, the framework is not necessary to many of the practices of these scientific disciplines. Okay? We're only attacking the framework. Okay? The old age issues and so forth. Accommodation is the lingo that you will read when you get into this kind of a literature. So you want to be familiar with this term. And I hope by going through all these accommodation theories from the theistic evolution and the day-age day theory and the day-age theory and progressive creationism and framework hypothesis and all these attempts and some of the various gap views and so forth, that you will see that the pressures of modern paganism beginning around 1800 have really come strongly upon Christian men in the church, and that under those pressures they succumbed. And so we have to be honest, okay? I understand that there is reputation in academia today. And if you don't go along with the modern paganistic framework, you will be, you know, ostracized. You won't get published. You won't get recognition. So the pressures to succumb to the framework are great. But if we're going to fear God and not man, then we're going to have to go along with what the Bible says and just let the chips fall where they may. After a while of accommodating, you realize anyway you've damaged the authority of Scripture so much, it'd be better if this from the start, if these believers had just said, you know, no, I think paganism is wrong, and somewhere I think the paganistic interpretations of the data have gotten off track. And we're going to go back and reevaluate and stick with the text. We're going to reinterpret the data that you're discovering, which is wonderful data. We're going to reinterpret it in terms of the text and not the other way around. Now, these two accommodation attempts I'll show you tonight move outside of Creation Week. So they're not involved in Genesis 1-2. They're involved in Genesis 5 and Genesis 11. Since 1800, see, A.D., we've got to have more time. Got to have more time. Before that, Christians didn't think of having more time. But that's what we mean by accommodation, that an external influence is coming on and it is affecting or disturbing how people read. Okay, it's affecting reading ability, if you want to call it that. So we got to inject more time into the genealogies of Genesis 5 and Genesis 11. Okay, the basic position is this. The genealogies in Genesis 5 and 11 contain generational and chronological gaps and thus cannot be used as James Usher did for chronological purposes. Names are often added, omitted, or changed in form. Now, this is a common position. Once again, I mean, this is in evangelical circles. This isn't liberal or neo-orthodox. Okay, this is conservative, evangelical. You know, like people like we would hold hands with. Okay? Now, and they're saying that this is the claim that the Old Testament does not give precise data for determining the age of the earth. It behooves us to remember what Leupold, famous commentator on Genesis, said years and years and years ago regarding this. Any claim that the Scriptures do not give a complete and accurate chronology for the whole period of the Old Testament that they cover is utterly wrong, dangerous, and mischievous. Notice, he's not just concerned with Genesis, is he? He's talking about the whole Old Testament. He says, that's utterly wrong, and there's some mischief going on when you read commentators, and they're saying, and these are conservative commentators, okay, they're saying, well, we can't really know from the Old Testament with the thousands of numbers that are there. You know, by the way, we can't do it. Okay, so the walls of orthodoxy have been breached on this issue. Okay, one of the breaches is here in Genesis 5. Are there gaps in the genealogies of Genesis 5 and 11? Well, before we even try to answer that question, we might ask this question. Is Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, are they strictly genealogies or are they chronologies? There's a difference between a genealogy and a chronology. Okay, you might want to know that, which we're looking at here before you slice and dice the text. What's the difference between a genealogy and a chronology? Well, a genealogy shows lineal descent, but it can have gaps. Example, Matthew chapter 1. Okay? It's there. They're not great gaps, but there are gaps. But a chronology can't have gaps. How could a chronology have gaps? How good is a chronology if it's got gaps in it? A chronology is a measurement of what? Time. So if I leave things out, then it ceases to be a what? Chronology. It's like having a clock. And the ticker, for some reason, stops, but time really keeps going. And then it starts ticking again. Now, is that a very good clock, or should you get a new one? Well, if you want to know what time it is, you should get a new one. So this is an attempt to say that time was going on in Genesis 5, more time than is there, but the hand wasn't ticking during all this time. So what that does is it stretches out the time in Genesis 5. Okay, it makes it longer. Okay, so it's usually, the claim is that what Genesis 5 is really describing here as we look at it is a schematization. It's a scheme. That the whole thing has been smoothed out, see, and made really fluid and beautiful by Hebrew editors. And they come to this conclusion because they say, look, if we count the number of guys in Genesis 5, there's 10. And if we count the number of guys in Genesis 11, there's 10. And if I count the Sumerian king list in ancient literature, I count 10 guys. And this literary parallel shows me that it's not historical. It's just a scheme that the Hebrew people came up with to make the text read better. Now here's the problem. The ancient Sumerian king list and others, ancient literature, that have the 10 guys do not have the formula that we have in Genesis 5 and 11. In Genesis 5, a very strict formula is used that any mathematician would automatically detect as giving a very strict, tight chronology. Okay, that would be the purpose, a major one at least, in writing this way, is that you want to write a chronology. Observe the formula, and I've got a slide for this. This is the formula. Just look at the top first. X lived n number of years and begat Y. And the days after he begat Y were n number of years. And all the days that X lived were n plus n years. Okay? So we'll look at the first one. Here it is. Adam lived 130 years and begat Seth. And the days after he begat Seth were 800 years. And all the days that Adam lives were 130 plus 800 years. And they've already done the math, haven't they? What does it say at the end of Genesis 5:5? How old was Adam when he died? 930 years. Then look at the second one. He takes Seth. Okay, where did he get Seth from? He got him from here, right? Adam begat Seth. So we take Seth now, and Seth lived 105 years. He begat Enosh, and the days after he begat Enosh were 807 years, and all the days that Seth lived were 105 plus 807 years, which equals how many years? 912 years. Okay? Then in number three, he picks up Enosh. Okay, where did he get Enosh from? He grabbed him from Seth, right? So he's just taking that kid and moving him. See that? Okay, all the way down. So he's connecting real tight. And then he gives the data about each one of these men. So each one picks up the son mentioned, and he gives the data in this formula. So we have Enosh, he begets Kenan. We have Kenan begetting Mahalel, Mahalel begetting Jared, Jared begetting Enoch, and Enoch begetting Methuselah, and it goes on a couple more. Now, we're not saying, okay, listen to what we're not saying. We're not saying that the son mentioned here is the firstborn son of the father. I mean, Seth, obviously, is not the firstborn son of Adam. Who was the firstborn son of Adam? Cain. He's the first human being born in the way that you and I were born into the world. You know, there's four different ways people have been born in the world. We won't go into that. That's another lesson. But I'll let you think about it. Can you come up with the four different ways that human beings have come into the world? So he's not giving the firstborn son necessarily, okay? But he's giving the generations. These are generations. Each one of these is a generation. How many generations bridge the period between the creation and the flood? Well, if we count Genesis 5, we'll see 10 generations. Okay? 10 generations from creation to the flood. Did y'all get some handouts? Okay, yeah, the Genesis 5 one, you could kind of pass some enough that they can, you know, shove them down the rows. Go on and turn to Jude 14. Enoch was number what from Adam? Here's a question. Enoch was number what from seven from Adam? Number what? How many generations?
Seven.
Okay, well, let's see what Jude says. Jude was the half-brother of Jesus, right? So this guy was raised in Jesus' own house with Jesus' family, with Joseph and Mary and others, where they taught, I'm sure, and discussed the Bible. And this obviously reflects that family's understanding of Genesis 5. Jude says in verse 14, "And about these also Enoch in the seventh generation from Adam prophesied, saying." So how many generations did we just say Enoch was from Adam? Seven. Jude says he was the seventh. So here we have a guy right in Jesus' family. He's agreeing with Genesis 5. The accommodationists say, Genesis 5 leaves some generations out. Excuse me? That wasn't Jude's understanding. That wasn't Jesus' family's understanding. I beg to argue that that wasn't Jesus' belief. Oh, well, it takes a higher order of intelligence to hold our position. See, Jude didn't have all the PhDs that we do. See, you can't play fast and loose with the text. A person would have far more integrity just to throw the Bible out and say the Bible's wrong. Okay. There's absolutely no reason to assume the existence of gaps in this record. Okay, here's Gordon Wenham. Okay, I have his commentary in my office. Wenham believes there are gaps. Okay, but listen to this frank admission. He believes there are gaps, and yet he says this. The Hebrew gives no hint that there were large gaps between father and son in this genealogy. Well, if that's the case, why do you believe there's gaps? Archaeological discoveries and historical problems compel to accept that there are. Where do the historical and archaeological problems come from? Do they come from the text, or do they come from outside the text and impose based on criteria that archaeology in its modern sense and historical criticism is set up out of a pagan framework that has exalted itself against the Word of God? See? If you start outside the text and you generate this criticism, borrowing a pagan framework, yeah, you're going to find problems with the text. They're built on pagan presuppositions. He says Adam lived in very distant times, much more than 6,000 years. Now turn to Luke 3, 36 to 38. This is one of Jesus' genealogies. There's a little debate through church history over Jesus' genealogies. You've got Matthew's genealogy and Luke's genealogy, and supposedly there's this contradiction, see, because as we read them, we get different names. Well, maybe did you ever think that these genealogies are the two different parents? You know, radical solution. Those dimwits come along at 90 miles per hour. Oh, we've got to find a contradiction here. Finally, after 2,000 years, man evolved a brain. It's really striking to see how ignorant people are after the 19th century. It's really shocking. Far from evolving, it appears that human beings in the last 200 years have been devolving rapidly. Look at the list of men we have on the chart here. And look at the list of men we have beginning in Luke 3:38. We'll work backwards. We have to work backwards because Luke starts with Jesus and works his way back to Adam. So it's reverse. Verse 38, who do you see at the end of the verse? Adam. Okay, he's number one. Then we have Seth. And we keep going backwards. We have Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared. Okay, then we come to Enoch. He's number seven, right? So he agrees with Jude too. Luke and Jude and the author of Genesis all agree. Accommodationists don't agree. I think I'm going to go with Luke, Jude, and author of Genesis. Who are you going to go with? Okay. And he keeps on going through the 10 that are listed there in Genesis chapter 5. You can go up to Noah. So see, the formula of Genesis 5 locks you down. In fact, you can go to 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, and you'll find the same list. 1 Chronicles 1, 1 through 4. They didn't know that there were other people in there that they just forgot to put. And ages of time passed. Now the last thing we want to observe with the Genesis 5 chronology is the age of these patriarchs. I just handed out a chart to you. Look at how old those people are when they died. I don't have the chart, but what is it? Column 1, 2, 3, 4? The fourth one from the left. Is that how old they were when they died? Total age? In the Genesis 5, fourth column from the left, total age. Look at the ages of these guys. 930, 912, 905, 910, 895, 962, blah, 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 blah. Okay, Enoch, he's 365. That's because he was taken. He didn't die. Okay, 969. Okay, these are the ages of the guys before the flood? I mean, that's shocking. The average age of these guys, without figuring in Enoch, because he didn't die, is 912 years. That's the average. And of course, people say, well, that just can't be right, because nobody lives that long today, and we're at the peak of evolutionary development, and therefore, their month must have been equivalent to our year. They had 30-day year back then, and that gets us down into the right range. Again, you have more integrity just to let the Bible go than try to hang on. Just let it go. Go on. Okay, there are issues here. If we take these guys, these 10 generations, and we plot these generations on the x-axis, and on the y-axis, okay, so here's our generations, 1 through 10 before the flood, right? Creation to the flood, 10 generations. On the y-axis, we're going to plot their age at death, okay? And here's the little dots out here. We draw a best fit line, and it's a pretty straight line. Okay, Enoch was down here. We're not considering him. There'd be a small dip there in the line. Now, that's a nice flat line. The last guy, the last righteous guy to die in that line before the flood was this guy, Methuselah. His name means, when he dies, it will come. Okay, he died the year of the flood. What came the year he died? The flood. Okay, when he dies, it will come. That's what his name means. Now let's turn to Genesis 11, 10. Okay, we'll plot these guys. You should be getting another handout coming now. This is the second genealogy we said where people come along and they say, oh, well, we've got to insert more time here to accommodate. This one comes after the Tower of Babel. Okay, you've heard of the Tower of Babel. So we have the creation, right? Then we have 1,656 years. You can do the math. And after 1,656 years, you get to the flood. Then 101 years after the flood, we have the Tower of Babel. And the Tower of Babel, out of that come the confusion of languages that we have today, the various language groups. Before that, everybody spoke the same language and the same words. And people today are trying to get back to that, see? Alexander the Great tried to get back to that too, because Alexander the Great was a one-world type of guy. And these one-world types of guys know that to get a one-world system, we've got to get a one-world language going. They're very smart people. They're right. If you're ever going to get unity of the human race, you've got to have a unified field of language. The big thing that businesses are looking for today, people who are multilingual, who can go carry on business any place in the world, any continent. So if you want to make a lot of money, go be one of those guys. Learn about 7 or 8 languages. But see, the guys today, I don't know anybody that is as good a scholar as Robert Dick Wilson in the 1920s. Fundamentalists knew 25 languages, including every Semitic dialect, fluently. Another example that we've devolved. See, this is when the language is divided at this point. Before this, for 1,656 years, actually 1,757 years of history, everyone spoke the same language, the same words. Now, God isn't against the one-world system, by the way. Okay, He's just against a one-world system that's built by the autonomous dictates of man. And so at this point, God is dividing the languages to disrupt this one-world system that's being built by men. And now we have the various language groups today that comprise modern civilization. Basically, the threefold system, and they stem from the three sons that are come forth from Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Those three sons of Noah, including Noah and Noah himself, are the progenitors of modern civilization. Everyone on the planet comes forth from one of those three sons. Everyone. And modern genetics is pointing to this right now as we speak. It's pointing out a monogenetic origin of man. That we all came from one family, not a polygenetic origin of man. And here are the records for Shem in Genesis 11, verse 10 and following. See, this is where you get to kind of glimpse the importance of this course, and that we had to totally relearn all of our history that we've been taught. Everything changes rather than the upward development of man. In an evolutionary framework of history, we have a totally new framework and way of thinking. Now, you'll notice a formula similar to that here in this genealogy or chronology and similar to Genesis 5. If you just sort of start looking at them, you'll see X was n numbers of years old when he begat Y, and X lived n numbers of year after he begat Y. The only thing that he doesn't add in here is, and the total number of years was you know, X number of years. But any fourth grader can do the math. Okay, it's not that hard to add how many years he lived before he begat him and how many years he lived after he begat him. It's not difficult. So it's almost exactly the same as the formula in Genesis 5. And what do we say that indicates when you have this formula? It's a strict, tight chronology being given. Any mathematician can see this. Okay, but the accommodations, they say, oh, we can stick time gaps in there, see? That won't be a problem if we just get a little more time, right? Oh, yes. It will be a serious problem. You're going to see that when you destroy this, that's not Bible study. Okay, this is manipulation of God's infallible speech. God is trying to communicate to us here. Look at this. Here, did I give you a chart? Look at your chart on the Genesis 11 guys that come down through Shem. Look at their ages at death. The fourth column again, 1, 2, 3, 4, total age. What are those men dying later, or are they dying earlier than the guys before the flood? Earlier. This is a part of that post-flood decay I was talking about the very first week we met. Look at what happens when you plot these guys. Okay, so I'm going to add to this diagram here. And I've got one here. Look at what happens when we plot their ages out here. Okay? Look at that. Now, there's not an engineer here that doesn't immediately know what that curve is. You could not be an engineer and not know what that curve is. What do you call that curve? Exponential decay curve. Okay, take a glass of hot water with your kids and put a thermometer in it. Okay? Get the thermometer, just room temperature water. Put a thermometer in there, let it come to equilibrium, then drop 5 ice cubes in there, and start every 20 seconds to 30 seconds plotting, writing the temperature down. Okay? And then plot temperature versus time, and you're going to come up with that exact same curve. It's called an exponential decay curve. As far as we know, everywhere you go in the physical universe, you get this curve when you move from one steady state, let's say room temperature water, to ice cold water. Okay? It's striking. When you read this text, what do you think? You know, I think Moses pulled out his TI-81 calculator and said, all right, let's start here. And then he pressed the logarithmic key and he came up with this exponential decay curve and punched the numbers into the text. The Bible is reporting this is what shows the reality of the Bible. The Bible is saying, this is tremendously important. But if you had millions of years there between the guys, you don't get that curve. You get a straight line. The mythologies don't plot like this because the mythologies remember a golden age too when men lived tens of thousands of years. But if you plot their ages, it goes something like before the flood, it's like 100,000 years for this guy, next guy lived 200,000 years, so it's this big curve. And then you have remembrance of the flood and then a sharp break off. In other words, it's a step function, not an exponential decay function. Isn't it striking? See that the Bible alone has the traits of real history? When you look at it carefully, this is the spirit of truth when you see this. He's left indelible marks all over the text that just scream out, look, this is reality. Look at this. If we just take the time to do these little experiments with the text and be intellectually honest enough to absorb them, we'll be impressed with God. So one of the major points of the text of Genesis 5 and 11 is to say, look at that chart again, how many generations do we have from creation to the flood? And how many generations do we have from the flood to Abraham? 10. What's the major difference between those two periods? Those two groups of 10? It's the ages of those people. Over here you got a lifespan on average 912 years. Over here you rapidly drop down to 70, 80, 90 years at best. Okay? And hot air. A lot more hot air on this side, though. Okay. Now, that's a tenfold reduction in lifespan. Tenfold! What happened such that the human body that once lived 900 years now lives, at best, 90? What is God telling us by this observation? The difference in these two worlds, the one before the flood and the one after, is a radical difference. How do you explain this change in human longevity? What caused this? Think of all the body chemistry and the details of how complex and wonderfully made we are, as the psalmist expresses. What on earth caused this tremendous deterioration from what we were originally made to be? We're little pygmies compared to those men that lived in the world before the flood. If we showed up back there, I'm sure one of them would say, "Hey, would somebody call a doctor? Something's wrong with this guy. What's wrong with this kid? Are you okay?" You see, we'll make some speculations about what happened genetically and environmentally as we get further into the class. But undoubtedly, every engineer will tell you that there was a change in steady state that occurred because of what? A local flood over in Mesopotamian Valley? Somebody's bathtub spilled over? Friend, changes in steady state don't take place because somebody's bathtub overflowed. We're talking about a global phenomenon that occurred right there. It's very clear and very easy to see in the text of God's Word. All right, so as a concluding note sort of to all the accommodationist theories that we looked at, we'll turn now in the coming weeks to the traditional interpretation. And by tradition, we mean the tradition of the Jews, the tradition of the apostles in the earlier church, what Jesus said. They all said the earth is young. And the irony is, on the part of the accommodationists, they come along in 1850, right? They start making all their arguments. Are you really saying that all these people, including the apostles, Jesus, and all the Old Testament Jews, were ignorant about the interpretation of Genesis until you guys came along in 1850? I mean, come on, we're on a basic issue. Are you saying we needed Hutton and Lyell to write their geology text before we could get this right? Anyway, that points us in the direction we're headed, the traditional view of Genesis.